Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to learn about how the omega-3 fatty acids can protect you against heart disease and related death. And that's from the Intermountain Health Heart Institute out in Utah. We have about 11 other good studies, always from peer-reviewed literature, showing how lifestyle modification can add years onto your life. Also today, I'll be quoting about a page out of Chris Hedges' new article, How to Save the Planet and Ourselves. This is from TruthDig. And he's suggesting that we should rebel. And he's recommending Roger Hallam's book, Common Sense for the 21st Century. He talks about only nonviolent rebellion can now stop climate breakdown and social collapse, end quote. All right, we'll listen to what he has to say, but then I'm going to offer a counterbalancing argument and see whether or not either one makes sense to you. Also today, we're going to play a few video clips, including one that is about an Arkansas mother who obliterates Common Core in just 4 minutes. Also, an interview with an applicant for a job. I think you'll find it interesting. And banks don't lend money. That'll be explained in 3 minutes. And if time permits, a State Department docs connect Clinton and Nuland to steal Ukraine and Libya. And this is an interesting discussion. And it's behind the scenes. It's two levels deeper than what anything in the mainstream media or in Congress is discussing. And Nuland, by the way, was the third or fourth most powerful person in Hillary Clinton's State Department, and her husband is the most powerful neocon in America. Her whole family are neocons. And there was a WikiLeaks got some of her actual email exchanges and then a voice exchange showing that she was a part of sending billions of dollars, I believe up to $5 billion, into the Ukraine to unseat a democratically elected president and install another American puppet. Why isn't this being discussed at all? We'll get to that, and we'll have this analyst describe the events. That's our program. We have a lot to share, and we begin with the latest on health and healing. Should you take omega-3? Well, I say yes. Generally, you can get them from fish oil, but you can also get them from walnuts, flaxseed. There are a lot of good, rich omega-3 sources from vegan sources. But according to the American Heart Association, it really protects you. And this was based upon researchers at the Intermountain Healthcare Heart Institute and out in Utah. And they did a study on a number of patients, and they said, yes, it makes a difference. It's the DHA fraction that is the most powerful part of the omega-3. And it helped people with heart conditions. So it's good for your heart. That we know. In fact, it says that it can save their hearts. So one way to help your heart, take the omega-3 fatty acids each day. I'm suggesting anywhere from 1,300 to 2,000 milligrams a day. From Brigham and Women's Hospital, a study published in the American Journal of Epidemiology talks about how a healthful diet is tied to a lower risk of hearing loss. Now, this is a different type of study. And it simply says straight out that eating a healthy diet can reduce the risk of acquired hearing loss. And they collected data from the Nurses' Health Study, a conversation of hearing study. And researchers examined 3-year changes in hearing sensitivities and found that women whose eating patterns were more closely adhered to commonly recommended healthful dietary patterns, such as the dietary approaches to stop hypertension diet, the DASH diet, and the alternative Mediterranean diet, and the alternative healthy index diet, had substantially lower risk of declining hearing sensitivity. So that's good. so a healthy diet and better hearing. I mentioned on several occasions the power to your body once you start walking, but then I've also mentioned that very slow walking is not advantageous at all, but fast walking, brisk walking, or what we call power walking, is. There's two universities that have confirmed this just this week. One is University of Leicester, and the other is Loughborough University. Both are in the United Kingdom. And what they say is simple, and this was published in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings, that walking faster can add years to your life. So it doesn't matter how much you weigh. A recent study conducted by the National Institute of Health Research found that that walking fast really makes a difference. So the speed that you're walking can add years to your life. And there are a lot of studies on this. One was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, found that walking speed, along with age and sex, was a reliable predictor of life expectancy. Another study found that the risk of death decreases with higher walking intensity and increases with low walking pace. So listen carefully. The slower you walk, the more likely you are to die sooner. Now, they studied 474,919 people in this particular study, and the average age was 52. Now, here's what they found. For women and men, if you walk fast, you could get your life expectancy up to 86.7 to 87 years. For men, if you walk fast, you could be at 85.2 to 86 years. But if you walk slow, women, 72 years, and men, 64 years. 64 years and you're dead, 72 and you're dead, versus in women, 86. So we're dealing with a huge difference, 14 years. That's incredible. 14 years added onto your life expectancy if you walk fast. And for men, it's 13 years. So walk, build yourself up, of course. Don't just go out there and just start walking fast. You build up gradually and take your pulse. Make sure you have your blood pressure checked and your blood sugar checked. But then when you start an exercise program, you stretch and get loose first. You start off slow till your body is acclimated. And then you pick your pace up. And then you reach in about 5 minutes, you reach your full pace. And then hold that pace. And then near the end, take 5 minutes to cool down. And then when you stop, take your pulse rate and your blood pressure about 10 minutes later. It should be back to normal. From Henan University of Chinese Medicine in China comes a study about the protective effects of curcumin against chronic alcohol-induced liver injury. So for all the people who drink any quantity of alcohol, you're creating a toxic reaction, and it's unfortunate because that's to your liver. But there is a hepato, which means liver, protective agent. It's been used for centuries, and that's curcumin. And it didn't take a lot of curcumin. They were using in mice about 150 milligrams per kilogram once a day for 8 weeks, and they found that there was a substantial improvement in the liver. From the University of Sao Paulo and also Harvard University comes a study about how a healthy lifestyle can prevent over 20 cancers. That's good, because where I was growing up, there was never a word spoken about diet and cancer, or diet and heart disease, or smoking and heart disease, or smoking and cancer. That's how thorough the propaganda was at the time. Well, in Brazil, drinking alcohol and obesity and excessive weight and smoking and many other unhealthy lifestyle practices lead to a third of all deaths from 20 types of cancer, including the lung, the esophagus, the colorectum, etc. And this was published in the journal Cancer Epidemiology. So when you change your diet and you start to live healthily and you exercise, you can prevent at least 20 different cancers. That's important. From University of Buffalo, getting 5 or fewer hours of sleep a night is associated with a lower bone mineral density and higher odds of osteoporosis. This was published in the Journal of Bone and Mineral Research. They looked at 11,000 postmenopausal women from the Women's Health Initiative. And so the less sleep you get, the less mineralization you have in four sites, the whole body, the hip, the neck, and the spine, compared to women who slept 7 hours a night, and a difference was substantial. So make sure you're getting a good night's sleep. Three things that cause you to not get a good night's sleep: eating too late, and it turns your metabolism on. Secondly is having light in the room or electromagnetic pulses from cell phones or television, computers. Unplug anything with that is a computerized and has a blue screen. Also, anxiety. And what I suggest is you simply take a few moments, sit at your desk, write down what bothers you, and just make a list of what you'd like to deal with on the next day. By writing it down, say, tomorrow I'm going to deal with this, it releases that tension from having to focus upon it at night. That can help. From the Center for Integrative Medicine in Maryland comes a study about integrative and lifestyle medicine strategies, and including earthing. By the way, earthing is grounding, walking around barefoot, and the review of the clinical evidence. And it shows that earthing or grounding refers to the discovery that bodily contact with the Earth's natural electric charge stabilizes the physiology at the deepest levels and reduces inflammation and pain and stress and improves blood flow and energy and sleep and generates greater well-being. So that can be profound. And it's fundamental and often developed easily. You know, just when you're at home, you know, take off your shoes and socks, walk around. I don't recommend walking in some places without shoes, in the woods because of ticks, and also on the beach because syringes, hypodermic needles, yeah, unfortunately, they're there. And last time I went to the beach, I just put out a white sheet. I was sitting there reading and just enjoying it. And within about 40 minutes, there were no less than 4 ticks on the white sheet. I saw them. Now, I wouldn't have seen them if I didn't have a white sheet there. So, you know, that was fine. They're everywhere. And for those of you who have an environment where you can have chickens, chickens are wonderful and loving creatures. They have very unique personalities. They'll come right over and get in your lap and want you to hug them. And they eat a lot of ticks. Guinea hens eat a lot of ticks. I mean, a lot. And they also make noise when any stranger or other creature comes around that shouldn't be there. And the best at all of eating ticks is possums. Possums are immune from Lyme's disease, and they can eat thousands of ticks. So for those of you who think that somehow the possum is diseased and should be, you know, gotten rid of, no, they're one of the best friends you could have. When it comes to eating spiders and ticks, and guinea hens, we eat scorpions and even snakes. From Tohoku University School of Medicine in Japan comes a study about how improved adherence to Japanese diet will lower the risk of disability, especially if you're older. Now, they have one of the oldest populations in the world, the Japanese, but they also have one of the healthiest, oldest populations in the world because they have adhered to certain standards of the Japanese diet and exercise. They eat a lot of rice and miso soup and seaweed and pickles and green and yellow vegetables and fish and green tea. They have a very low intake of coffee, pork, and beef. And so the Japanese diet index, which ranges from 0 to 9, they categorize people and found out that the older a person is and following traditional Japanese diet, the more they're likely to stick with a healthy diet, and they're adding years, healthy years, onto their lifespan. Now, the younger Japanese are more inclined, because of social media and seeing all the ads, to want the new foods. The new foods are fast foods, the pizzas, the hot dogs, the hamburgers, and they're getting sicker. From the Institut Pasteur in France comes a study about the gut microbiota imbalance promotes the onset of colorectal cancer. Now, you've heard me mention many times that the health of the body starts in the gut, and that you really have two brains, one in the colon or the intestines and one in the skull, and they communicate with each other. And by taking in healthy living foods, what we call clean foods, not that they're physically clean, yes, they should be, but because they're clean, they haven't been sprayed with pesticides. They've been grown organically, locally, and that's the best food you can eat. And that creates a whole biome, a whole colony of good bacteria. That, in turn, helps prevent colorectal cancer. And this was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And finally, hair regenerative activities of the flavonoid-rich extract of horsetail. Horse, H-O-R-S-E, tail, T-A-I-L, one word. This is according to the Centro Escolar University in the Philippines. And they found in this study that, by the way, alopecia, which is very common around the world, and they used horsetail extract, and it was very favorable to causing new hair to grow. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're 60 minutes into our program. We're going to come back, and when we come back, we're going to go directly to an Arkansas mother challenging at a public hearing Common Core. She does it in 4 minutes.
Recognize Mrs. Karen Lamoureux, who is has 3 minutes to speak.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Madam Chairman and the Board. My name is Karen. I'm a mother of three in the Pulaski County Special School District. I am here today not speaking just on behalf of myself. I'm here representing 1,110 other parents, educators, and taxpayers in our state who have some very serious reservations about the Common Core Initiative. We are not alone in this regard. 6 other states have pulled out of their park agreement. 22 other states currently have legislation pending to either get out of Common Core or to make significant changes to it. After listening to what was said this morning, I have come to the conclusion that this board is clearly as uninformed as the parents are or were when these standards were adopted. We were told the same thing that you were told, and that Common Core is a set of rigorous college-ready, internationally benchmarked standards that prepare our kids to compete in a global economy. This is nothing more than an empty sales pitch for corporations and government agencies to profit from our kids and sell them downriver in the name of saving education. I have a math question for you board members. Are you ready? Get your pencils out. I'm not kidding. Are you smarter than a Common Core fourth grader? Let's find out. The problem is, Mr. Yamada's class has 18 students. If the class counts around by a number and ends with 90, what number did they count by? I'll restate the problem. Mr. Yamada's class has 18 students. If the class counts around by a number and ends with 90, what number did they count by? Does anyone on the board have an answer?
5.
And may I ask, madam, how did you come up with that answer? You know why? Because that's what makes sense, right? That's the way we were taught to do it in the fourth grade level. This, however, is what the Common Core standards expect our fourth graders to do. If they solve it in those 2 steps, they get it marked wrong. They are expected to draw 18 circles with 90 hash marks, solving this problem in exactly 108 steps. Board members, This is not rigorous. This is not college ready. This is not preparing our children to compete in a global economy. Skipping rote memorization of multiplication tables is hindering their ability to master long division and fractions later on in the semester. And now our children who were testing in the 80th or higher percentile in math last year are now coming home with C's, D's, and F's on their report cards. Not because, as Arne Duncan would put it, that white suburban mothers think their children aren't as brilliant as they thought they were, but because, thank you. I encourage you to listen to us when we send you our emails, despite the comments that were made by our chairperson here today. Our concerns are not based on hysteria or propaganda. They are based on fact, and we are prepared to present those facts. Can you see the trembling in my voice? Parents have not had a voice here, and you need to listen to our concerns. We are moving forward with our legislature to make some very serious changes to this, and all I ask is that you bend your ear and take us seriously. We are college-educated parents. I come to you with 12 years of college education and a former member of the National Honor Society when I tell you this is not working, and it's not what they told you it would be. We will save the privacy concerns and the testing concerns for our legislature. But when it comes to standards, that's your ball court, and we need you to help us with this because this program is dumbing our children down. Thank you.
Good for her. More people should stand up to some of these bureaucracies and how they're doing things for profit and not for helping the students. In fact, a lot of our schools have very large budgets compared to any other country in the world, and yet we're not graduating students who have critical thinking capacities, just teaching to the test. And ask yourself, who makes the profit from that? The test scoring companies and the administrators coming in, layers and layers of administrators. And that's one of the reasons, not the only reason, that we're having children who are not given the same advantage when they go out into the world that they should have or that we had growing up. That was a very interesting little example she gave. Now, to shift gears, let's see what happens when someone's only studied at the Common Core. This is an interview with an applicant.
Thank you. Come on in, have a seat. Of course. I have been looking over your resume, and I have to say I am very impressed.
Oh, thank you.
You know, actually, I think, to be honest, you are overqualified to be an accountant.
Oh, well, that's okay. I don't intend to work very hard.
Really?
Absolutely. In fact, I only intend to show up when I feel like it, which is good because I have a wide variety of extremely annoying personal habits and absolutely no sense of hygiene.
Oh! You know, then, I don't feel like you're then the correct person for this position.
That's okay, I quit.
You can't quit, you don't work here.
Like I would ever work here.
Like we would ever hire you.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, and even if you did work here, I wouldn't even give you the opportunity to quit because I would fire you.
Well, you can't fire me because I don't work here.
That's right, you don't, and I would can your ass so quick.
Prove it.
Okay. You've got the job.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And now it is my pleasure to inform you that
I quit.
You can't quit. I fired you.
No, it's too late. I don't work here anymore.
Fine, let's try this again. You've got the job and now you're fired.
No, you offered me the job, but I never accepted. Look, I've already worked for you. It's very tedious. And now you want me back. I think it's a regressive career move.
Okay, what can we do to get you to come work for us?
A raise.
A raise?
$200 an hour.
$200 an hour. Okay, prorated to the 10 seconds you're going to be working here, so 12 cents?
And this time I promise I won't quit.
You promise you won't quit? You promise you'll let me fire you?
If you still want to.
Oh, I'm sure I'm going to want to. So we have a deal?
Not yet. I've already been an accountant here. I feel like I've outgrown the position. I want something higher. How about junior vice president?
Junior vice president. $200 an hour or 12 cents, whichever comes first. And you promise not to quit before I have the opportunity to fire you.
That's correct.
Great. We've got the job.
I accept.
Great! Now you're fired!
Oh, you can't fire me. I'm junior vice president. I'm your boss.
What? That doesn't make sense.
And as your boss, I regret that I have to fire you.
Why are you firing me?
Well, I can't help but notice, as head of personnel, you've been hiring some very strange people lately. At $200 an hour for me.
What am I supposed to do without a job?
Well, we do have a new position opening up in head of personnel. Do you have any experience?
Okay. All right. Not too far off the mark there. I want to now go to an article by Chris Hedges. I'm just going to cite the first two paragraphs that I think are important. Chris, like most conscientious people in the United States, is very concerned about what's happening with our environment and the fact that those that we've entrusted in Congress, for example, or the heads of our agencies, are not in alignment with what the rest of Americans are concerned about. Nothing's getting done. I mean, nothing. Here's what he has to say. He's talking about a book by Roger Hallam, Common Sense for the 21st Century. Hallam's lucid and concise book, quote, which echoes Thomas Paine's Common Sense, says what many of us now know to be true, but do not say. If we do not replace the ruling elite soon, we are finished as a species. It is a cogent, well-argued case for global rebellion, the only form of resistance that can save us from ecosystem collapse and human-induced genocide. It correctly analyzes the failure of environmentalist activities and activists in groups such as 350.org to understand and confront global corporate power and thus make a meaningful impact as we barrel towards ecocide. Common Sense for the 21st Century is a survival manual for the human species. The corrupt system is going to kill us all unless we rise up, Hallam, a co-founder of Extinction Rebellion, bluntly warns. The activism, protests, lobbying, petitions, appeals to the United Nations, and misguided trust in liberal politicians such as Barack Obama and Al Gore, along with the work of countless NGOs, have been accompanied by a 60% rise in global carbon dioxide emissions since 1990. The United Nations estimates this will be augmented by a 40% rise in CO2 emissions in the next 10 years. Hallam, who has long been a part of the environmental movement, says of his past activism, quote, I was wasting my time. We must reduce carbon emissions by 40% in the next 12 years to have a 50% chance of avoiding catastrophic events, according to a report last year by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. But the ruling elites, as expected, ignored the warning or mouthed empty platitudes. CO2 emissions increased by 1.6% in 2017 and 2.7% increase in carbon dioxide last year. Carbon dioxide levels went up by 3.5 parts per million last year, reaching 415 parts per million. We are not a decade away, Hallam warns, from 450 parts per million, the level equivalent to a 2 degrees Celsius average temperature rise. Quote, let's be frank about what catastrophe actually means in this context. We are looking here at the slow and agonizing suffering and death of billions of people. A moral analyst might go like this. One recent scientific opinion stated that a 5% Celsius above the pre-industrial mean temperature, we are looking at an ecological system capable of sustaining just 1 billion people. That means that 6 to 7 billion people will have died within the next generation. Even if this figure is wrong by 90%, it still means 600 million people face starvation and death in the next 40 years. This is 12 times worse than the death toll civilians and soldiers in World War II, and many times the death toll of every genocide known to history. It is 1,200% worse than the horror of Nazism and fascism in the 20th century. This is what our genocidal governments around the world are willingly allowing to happen. The word genocide might seem out of context here. The word is often associated with ethnic cleansing or major atrocities like the Holocaust. However, the Merriam-Webster dictionary definition reads, quote, the deliberate and systematic destruction of a racial, political, or cultural group. It is time to grow up and see the world as it is. There are some things which are undeniably real. There are some things we cannot change, and one of those is the laws of physics. Ice melts when the temperatures rise, and crops die in a drought. Trees burn in forest fires, and because these things are real, we can also be certain about the future and what it holds. We are now heading into a period of extreme ecological collapse. Whether or not this leads to the extinction of the human species largely depends upon whether revolutionary changes happen within our societies in the next decade. This is not a matter of ideology, but of simple math and physics. And recent science shows permafrost melting 90 years earlier than forecast and Himalayan glaciers melting twice as fast as expected. Feedbacks and lock-in heating will take us over 2 degrees Celsius even before we factor in additional temperature rises from human-caused emissions over the next 10 years. In short, we are screwed. The only question is how much and how soon. Do we accept this fate? I suggest we do not. Many self-respecting people who can overcome the human failing to disbelieve what they don't like now accept what is obvious looking at the natural science, but they have yet to work through the political and social implications. Okay, so that's their position. So in effect, rebel against this. That may seem reasonable, but I'd like to share, and Chris and I are on the same site of a lot of these issues, but on this one, I would choose a different path. Let me explain. I've just completed, and I just last night watched the first clear-through draft of the new film on the environment. It can arguably be said that this is the most comprehensive film ever produced on the world we live in, and all the things going wrong. There have been outstanding films done on water and ice, a whole film just on ice, and it was galvanizing. Ones on acidification and the destruction of the Amazon. The several films have been done on industrial agriculture and monocrops. But this deals with every single thing that's going wrong. Dozens of different topics and some of the world's leading experts. It's taken 7 years to bring us to this point because things continue to evolve. And because we just finished it, we were able to put footage in concerning the first ever recorded Category 6 hurricane that hit the Bahamas with 224-mile-an-hour extended winds on the outer circle of it. That we've never seen before. Completely leveled the Bahamas. So what if you were living in the Bahamas and you were multimillionaire and you had lived there for 40 years and you never had a storm that did that much damage? You would have a chance to get on a private plane and zip out of there. It's a short trip from there to Miami or anywhere else you want to go. What about all the people who don't have private planes and they live in small houses, some with just 10 roofs? Where's their escape plan? There was none. Where was their plan B? There was none. Where there were backup supplies and backup generators and backup medical technicians there to help people as the storm hit? None. How about desalinization plant? Zero. How about backup water? Not a drop. The same was true for Puerto Rico. So when you are looking at the problem, understand who caused the problem. We all did. We would like to think that these are just greedy multinational corporations and that capitalism, as Naomi Klein said, capitalism caused global warming. I challenge that. Because all of us participate in capitalism. Even the social democrats, where do you think that money comes from? It comes from people paying taxes. And as we pay taxes, even though we don't have a fair tax system, there should be the only way for the rich and the corporations to pay taxes is that if you had a mandatory 20% tax on all corporate earnings, and that way everybody had to pay the same identical fair share. It's just the very rich and the very powerful who are making billions of dollars in profits would be paying billions of dollars in taxes. It is not by accident that we do not have a flat tax, a corporate tax. And they control the system because they control the legislation and the lobbyists. And so the rich will continue to sidestep anything that happens if it touches their profits. So the working class and the middle class, they're the ones who pay the burden of the highest share per person. But then we all consume. We give the largest single subsidies in the United States not to Medicare recipients who actually pay in the system, or Medicaid at the state level, or Social Security, which is not an entitlement program at all. The government doesn't match our funds. We alone, throughout our lifetime, pay into a trust that is supposed to give us back that money prorated over a period of time. But they borrowed over $2.7 trillion of that money from Ronald Reagan on to fund their wars and other schemes. And the American public was never made fully conscious of that. And yet it was Barack Obama who had plans to lessen the funds coming out of that. And sometimes it's just Social Security is the only funds people have to live on. As of today, 70% of all Americans, that's 70% as of today, I'm talking about news that came out early this morning, say that they are financially strapped for a multitude of reasons. We are a society of massive consumption and very little production. As a result, we're made to feel somehow that we must compete with each other in what we can consume. All you can eat food and getting huge amounts of food, but the big industries are all subsidized. The fossil fuel industry is massively subsidized. So it's getting welfare. But then again, General Motors got welfare. General Electric got welfare. Wells Fargo got welfare. Bank of America got it. J.P. Morgan got it. Chase got it. And Goldman Sachs got it. In fact, all the major corporations got welfare. So if you say you're against socialism, then why not start by closing down the corporations that have lived only on their profit that they don't share with us, but they did share their expenses and their poor judgments in business that we, the people, paid for? So there's only one side of the criticism on socialism and not honest about how these major corporations benefit from it. Think of all the vaccine makers. The CDC gives them large amounts of money in developing vaccines, and then the CDC owns the patent and then licenses back to that very company that was subsidized by American taxpayers, and then they give a fee back to the CDC. That's socialism. So we're not even literate enough and politically aware enough to understand how corrupt our system has become. But within that system, you have those who flee from any obligation to change their industries that are polluting, their lifestyles that are contributing, their private jets and eating the Colby beef when they fly into Davos for their meeting in Switzerland each year, up to 5,000 of the leading polluters in the world, or those representing countries or companies that pollute. Now, have you seen any discussion about America's military being the number one polluter in the United States? Not a word. Are there any rules to keep them from doing all the things they do that cause pollution? Nothing. Is there anything to prevent the Chinese government from continuing massive urbanization programs that are contributing to this global increase? Nothing. How about India? Nothing. How about burning the forests in Borneo and Africa? Nothing. How about South America and the lungs of the planet being destroyed at two football fields per 60 seconds? Nothing. And then what happens when no one wants to do anything really meaningful is that there's a cumulative effect of living in cognitive disconnect. We just don't want to be honest about the fact that we may say I'm an environmentalist or I care about the planet, or of course people will say that. But what have we done? Nothing. We haven't done anything. The rich and powerful are always the first to claim they're socially responsible. But are you talking about the people in Hollywood? The vast majority live behind walls to protect them, but they're against a wall. They're against guns, but there are armed guards guarding them. They're against excessive pollution, but they fly on private jets. And only a handful are actually vegan and live conscientious lives. Mark Ruffalo is just one example. A good guy who cares about, you know, the planet, is a vegan, and advocates. But he's the exception, not the rule. So we have these virtue-shaming celebrities and politicians, a corrupt duopoly. Both parties are equally corrupt. It's just as historically, we didn't believe that the Democrats could be as vile as the Republicans or as insensitive. Well, that's our fault for not paying attention. All we had to do look is Haiti over the decades, the support of Papa Doc Duvalier and his son, Baby Doc, and look at the arms manufacturing by both the Democrats and Republicans. Trump is being, you know, held as a major warmonger, and yet nothing was said when Hillary Clinton had a big celebration at the State Department when they had the largest sale of arms to Saudi Arabia at a time when Saudi Arabia was invading other countries, including Yemen, and supporting terrorism in the Middle East. So what does it say when a country can right now be responsible for 100,000 deaths and 20 million starvations in Yemen, and yet not a word comes up about condemning them or stopping to do a business with them? They kill a guy, we have all the proof, and yet nothing is done to the person who is killing them because we make money from them or we trade with them, and that's true with many of the countries around the world. So exactly who's supposed to help us? Generally, it's always the legislators. They have failed. They've been captured at the state and federal level. Then it's supposed to be those who are powerful enough and rich enough that they can actually, if they wanted to, they can actually be a decent human being. You know, they're billionaires. They will not be able to spend all the money they have in their lifetime. That's how rich they are. And no matter how many, you know, 400, 500-foot yachts they buy and $50 million planes and how many mansions they have. But still, they don't want to give it up. And they just want more. And they don't want to step out of the limelight. So holding on to power seems to be a fetish, and it's metastasized. I was told, I think it was Naomi Klein said, well, don't blame the baby boomers. No, it's the baby boomers who created this mess. We didn't have this mess before, and we've accelerated it because everybody wanted more. It was the me generation, and we succeeded. Everybody got more. And I can remember going in to meet my friend Dave, who was one of the owners with Steve, a Fairway, and saying, let's do a farm project together upstate. And he said, yeah, great idea. So we farmed in Goshen, and it was a great experience. And it's the richest farmland in America. It's black, what's called black soil. It's so loose that when you walk on it, the ground shakes. Everything grows. And I took bushel baskets down to Fairway, and nobody bought anything. At the end of a week, he threw it all away. And he was pricing it at 50% less than the pesticide regular produce. It's just people weren't into the concept of organic. We were there, we had it, but they didn't want it. There has to be education and marketing. Isn't it interesting? People would rather drink orange drink than orange juice and see no difference between a genetically engineered, you know, potato and a regular potato. There's a big difference. But that's where we come into the notion of intentional neglect. What we intentionally don't want to deal with, what realities we don't want to face, we will neglect the deeper discussions, the more honest and open discussions of what are the likely outcome if we don't do anything, if we don't change. Well, I've addressed this. I show both the problem and the solution. And so then we look upon our professional class. That's the largest single class of educated people in the United States, and it's formidable. China has more people now, by the way, highly educated people, what we would call careerists. And when you add in the 17 million with the 10 million millionaires, you're 27 million. Let's be very conservative. Let's just say that we have roughly around more or less 30 million people. And if you add in two extra members to a family, one child and a spouse, then you're dealing with upwards of around 85 to 90 million people. In a country of 232 million, that's a sizable amount. So if they came forward because they're respected, they're the surgeons and the accountants and the hedge fund leaders, and they said, let's use all of our resources, let's go to our Rolodexes, and let's see if we can do something positive for our environment. Let's start planting trees. Let's start going vegan. Let's start growing hemp. And let's make our clothes and paper out of hemp so we don't have to fell the trees. And let's stop all these excessive purchases of things that influence the environment. That would make a difference, especially if it were done in a way that also motivated other countries in the world, some of whom are already doing that. That would be a very positive step. But we're not doing it because people are so interested in their careers and what the career will give them and the standard of living, and they're assuming the more standard of living they have, the greater quality of life. It's just the opposite. The greater your standard of living, the less quality of life, because you're so stressed. You have so little quality time when you're working nonstop to get stuff, to achieve stuff, that by the time you finally figure out that maybe you should exhale and enjoy your relationships, enjoy your life, your friends, that is past. And we have a lot of dissolved relationships because they were never nurtured. They were a beautiful rose, and one day they wilted because you didn't pay attention to what you had right in front of you. So we keep making wrong mistakes, but we think, okay, well, I'll do it again. This time I'll do it a little differently. Well, I haven't seen that yet. What I see is we have whole industries of helping people better understand why they're so unhappy, even though they should be very grateful for what they have. So if the professional class is not out there, and they're not, I've had hundreds of demonstrations I've either led or been a part of, and I don't see those people. If the very wealthiest are not going to give up anything, and they're not going to devote themselves to de-ghettoizing America, bringing industry back to the United States, which they could do. They could absolutely do that. They had the power. They could have zones in every major city in America to rebuild the working class, give them what we had in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and the beginning of the 70s, a living wage so you could have a standard of living, forgive a lot of debt, especially student debts, and stop all payday loans, and close down all debtors' prisons and private prisons, and start taking the excessive profit out of everything that we need as a quality of life. Well, then suddenly you stop all the income inequality. And then with that, you're able to better focus upon how we can universally, as a Marshall Plan, save the planet. Now, all the experts I have filmed, as you will see, don't believe that we have 10 years before we make major changes. We are the opinion now that we have about 3 years, as all around the world, even today as I speak, you'll have some of the worst fires in the world, worst flooding in the world, drought. Give you an example. Did you know that Sydney, Australia, the largest city in Australia, I think it's either Brisbane or Perth is second, but they're running out of water. And when I say running out of water, I mean there's no more water. They had 3 years of straight drought. They have a population of about 5 million people. And it's one of the more beautiful cities in the world. They're going to have to build desalinization plants because, and on a massive scale, probably about 100 of them. But that's going to take several years. They're going to be out of water before that happens. No one planned. No one thought. Now, all the people that are living in the country, they're seeing all their livestock die. Now, I'm opposed to livestock, but I'm more opposed to livestock dying because there's thousands of dead cows and horses and sheep. There's no water. All their creeks are gone. Their water table's down. So all the people that were out in the farmlands, there's no water, so they're moving to the cities, further stressing the meager water that Sydney has. The fifth largest city in India, huge city, is running out of water. They're having to ship it in. In Sydney, they're having to ship water to towns all over the country. Now, this is not like it's cyclic. Okay, right now for the next 3 months, they're going to have a rough time, but then it's all going to bounce back. It's not bouncing back. In Cape Town, South Africa, 4 million people, they're running out of water. We're not talking about temporarily running out of water. They're running out of water. The Great Rockies, that if you've ever been out there, it's a wonderful place to see, the Grand Tetons, what you see up through there from Wyoming and Montana, you'll see mountains that are covered early in October, sometimes even September, with snow, and then by the middle of the winter, it can be 6-10 feet deep, and then it releases itself slowly over many months in the warmer weather, and that provides water for irrigation, to refill aquifers, depending upon the type of aquifer. But all that is now because of global warming. It's melting very fast, so the flooding is not helping restock the water supply, recharge it. And so you're going to see the Little Colorado, which supplies 39 million Americans with their water from Arizona and Nevada clear over through California, Southern California. In 10 years, there'll be legal battles left and right because there won't be enough water for everyone. That's the reality we're faced with. But again, the wealthiest people, the most educated people, the policymakers and opinion leaders are not devoting time to making this a priority. They've made other things a priority. They're assuming someone else will deal with this problem. The trouble is there is no one else to deal with it. The poor, well, take a look at Los Angeles, take a look at Seattle, take a look at Portland as just some examples, and San Francisco, where at one time, you know, San Francisco, one of those beautiful cities in America, and Seattle as well, they've been completely ghettoized, and now they're passing laws to accommodate the poor. So people can defecate, you know, any place. They've even made stealing now not a crime. Well, okay, it's one thing to criminalize poverty. That they should not do. But what happens if you're a little store owner and people come in there to steal and you can't do anything about it? And what about walking down the street and it's no longer safe? Wouldn't it make sense if they put their time and energy into building an entire environment for homeless people with all the things they would need, re-education, clinics, health clinics, a cafeteria so they could have 3 school meals a day, a family settings, single settings, psychological help. This is what a homeless person needs because many of them have mental problems, others have addiction problems, and some don't have mental or addiction problems. They just have lost a place to live. So why didn't we change the laws, Occam's razor, cut out all the nonsense and say to the banks, as Barack Obama could have done and chose not to because his money would later come from them, why not say you can no longer foreclose on a person, you must leave them where they're at and reduce your request with no penalties, no interest to 15% of what a person makes a month. Therefore, a person even with a limited Social Security can still afford to live without being thrown out. So the honest answer requires a different mindset. It requires one of spiritual balance and humanistic values. And we have neither anywhere, any longer, in any of our major institutions. They're purely mercenary. So the poor are not going to help out. They don't have the resources. And the working middle class are working 1 to 2 jobs. Many of them are homeless and still working 1 to 2 jobs. And yet the people who are retired are not asking themselves, maybe we should take a look at where our retirement funds and our pensions are being invested. All they're being invested in these, you know, corporations that make arms. Well, that's not ethical. But we don't say that. We don't stop where we invest because of the ethics of how the money is made, as long as it gives us the return so we can maintain our lifestyle. So you have people living in denial. Gated communities are one of the worst, where people in those gated communities rarely, if ever, do they complain about anything or try to adjust any problem because they said, well, I put in my time, I'm in my retirement place now, so don't bother me. Someone else will take it on. Well, who exactly? The youngest generation is also the most financially limited, and their education system isn't meaning a whole lot for most because automation and artificial intelligence and the education visa are bringing people and machines in, they're taking their jobs. So we're not even honest in our educational institutions. Why it costs so much to go to school? So you see, if you look, pull back at the problem, and you see that who's left to actually do anything about the environment? And the answer is no one. and to remind us that no one in America is doing anything. I don't mean that every single person. There are many people who are doing something, but they're not doing enough. And just a few percentage of people cannot do enough to make these changes at the tipping points that are occurring now and will in the next couple of years. We're talking about in the next 3 years, we're going to start seeing major, major catastrophes around the world with exceptional weather events. So that's where we're at. So it takes a 16-year-old young girl who is, I believe, honest and very dedicated, but with a whole group of people around her who are trying to get carbon caps, which would make a lot of people billions, if not trillions of dollars, and is manipulating her. So, all right, she came. She had more media than any other personality in American history in a short period of time. What exactly has changed? Nothing. What will change? Nothing. So she can yell out at the people at Davos, and they'll applaud her. Did they put down that fork filled with beef or chicken or fish? No. Did they fly back commercial? No. Or take a train? No. Private jets. Because they know what the game is. It's easy to manipulate someone. As long as you're hiding behind them when they're out on stage and promoting something everybody says, yeah, we should do something about. No, but we're not going to do anything about it. And that's where I differ with Chris and Naomi Klein. We're not going to have a mass uprising in America. We're not in enough pain yet. We haven't demonstrated against the ghettoization, the loss of over 25 million Americans' homes, not that way when you add out 7 million homes, but we didn't care what happened to them. We had no demonstration against the Defense Spartan Military Industrial Complex, Citizens United, the Glass-Steagall Act, the corruption of the Clintons. Nothing do we find interesting enough to demonstrate against. And so I don't see this as going to be a good. Individually, yes, we can make changes and should. And I'll deal with that, what we can do individually and in small groups. But as a collective whole, we've passed the deadline. Every single person that I filmed has said that. We had our moment, and we missed it. We didn't show up on time, and we're not going to stop and deaccelerate our growth. Industry will come first. Profiteering off that will come right behind it, and environmental consequences speeding up will come third. So who are you going to call? Where are you going to go? What are you going to do? Who's going to be there when the insurance companies stop insuring you or giving you only, as they tried with me, 3% on the hurricane damage? That's what we're faced with. But we still have to suffer a lot more, unfortunately and regrettably, until finally we have someone's attention. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.